Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. David Jennings, lawyer, businessman, theological thinker, philanthropist, social critic and cultural entrepreneur, superb board member for so many church and arts organizations, son of the Presbyterian Church, friend and interlocutor. Our wide-ranging conversation touches areas largely foreign to me, and perhaps to some of you. He invites us to think again about matters too easily dismissed by party politics and ideological purity. David combines, as few do, superb legal analysis with equally superb theological thinking. When Karl Barth, who stands alongside the Apostle Paul, Maximus the Confessor, Augustine, Aquinas, and Calvin, came to America in 1962, he met William Stringfellow. Stringfellow was a lawyer, like John Calvin and David. Barth said Stringfellow was the finest theological mind in America. If the great theologian were to come today and was fortunate enough to meet David, he would laud him as well. My own thinking is always enlarged by the conversations we have had over the years, moving in areas I've only occasionally considered. What is the purpose of law? Not just how it functions, technically, as a profession, but the why of law. Why is justice important? Similarly, what gift does business bring to our common life? What is the inner dynamic of the business person? The way one must engage in a full range of considerations to accomplish a stated purpose and live or die based on one's judgment, decisions, and relationships. Does the conservative tradition, capital C conservative, still exist within our political parties? And is capitalism, as some have recently argued, at the end of its tether? Well, it may be a stretch for some, certainly not for David. How does the Christian understanding of the Incarnation and the Trinity shift thinking on these practical questions and move them beyond the usual theological reduction imposed by ideology on both the right and the left? Finally, there is the question of stewardship and philanthropy. What has motivated David and others to devote half their time and all their skill and energy to seeing that artists and others with cultural vision may flourish? Welcome to our conversation.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
So, David, one of the lovely things about knowing you has been to get to know Calvin a little bit. To get to know Calvin from the perspective of somebody who loved Calvin, who loves Calvin, and whose father and lineage goes back to that extraordinary Swiss man. He was a lawyer, wasn't he, as well?
He was. Jean Covin.
That's right, yeah. So, I suppose it's not surprising, then, that you are a lawyer. So can you... I would be interested in... You know, you've talked with me a bit about your father and your upbringing and the depth of the connection to the Presbyterian Church, and then your education, studying philosophy a bit, literature a bit, history a bit, and then law. Did your father expect you to become a minister?
Well, I guess the trick answer here is I wasn't predestined to be that. but a more nuanced answer was, no, my father never expected that. As a matter of fact, I think that's, my father was a Presbyterian minister himself, and I think that was one of the great gifts he gave me, was there were no expectations. I think any father can learn from that. Not to have expectations of your child, because then you can encounter who they are, rather than who you wish them to become. For a lot of us, from what I observe, I don't have any of my own, But when you are seeing grandparents, when they encounter the grandchild, it might be the very first time when a person encounters someone else for who they are rather than who they wish them to become. You know, I see grandparents where, you know, it doesn't matter about what your education is. It doesn't matter whether you've misbehaved that morning with the parents or whatever else. You just love them to bits. Those are the stories I hear from grandparents. And I think that what's rooted in that is actually being able to be present with the person and not with the expectation. So for me, no, my father had, it might sound inappropriate, he had low expectations or he had no expectations of me that he ever articulated, really, except for in one instance. But I think that's, you know, there are four of us in our family, one who hates the church.
Four children, you mean?
Yeah, I have three brothers, so four children of my mother and father. One who hates the church for a variety of reasons, but it wasn't because of my father. More of a philosophical thing. One who isn't upset by it, but you know is you know would never bother to think that a Sunday morning should be spent worshiping God. One who is engaged from time to time in that, and then I'm sort of the all-in guy. And what I loved about was when my father died, all of them agreed that he had no favorites, which speaks to, I think, that expectation, that he didn't place on us. We weren't an object. And at the time...
Or he had four favorites.
Oh, yeah, four favorites.
Each one knew that they were it.
Yeah, exactly. Nah, I think it was the former, but it's true. You can also do the latter. I think that, you know, and in the 60s and the 70s, it was still the case we were pretty Christendom, at least in Ontario. And there were expectations placed on a lot of preachers' kids, expectations of, you know, well, that's not the right way to do things sort of thing. And that's why I think you see so many rebel against that. So to, at the end of his life, have the four who have very different views of what was central to his life and yet believe that he didn't play favorites, that he didn't treat them as objects but as subjects. You know, very Martin Buber type of I-thou relationship rather than I-it. And so many became just simply objects for either the children's story or a sermon illustration or just simply so they could keep their job. Same with minister spouses as well, unfortunately. I think that was, you know, a mark of maturity of him as a man, that he didn't fall prey to that. But he did say in one occasion that he knew I was thinking about the ministry when I was 18 or 19 at the time. And, you know, I'd never articulated it to him because we're Northern Irish, so we wouldn't actually talk. But he did once say in the car, I'm thinking that this is what you're thinking. You know, you'll have to figure that out for yourself. But he said, you know, we have quite a few Christians who are clergy. I'm not sure we have that many Christians who are in business. And he didn't actually say law. I think law was probably beyond anyone's expectation. I just argued a lot, but I didn't know people thought that you get paid to do that. But that was his, I think that was his sole sort of expression of thinking that through. And for me, it was a gift. And I think for a lot of young Christians where they anticipate that if you're going to be serious about your Christianity, you go into the ministry. It's wonderfully freeing to hear, no, actually, and these aren't my father's words, but these are words I've gained since, you know, that our vocation is not into full-time ministry of word and sacrament or into full-time ministry of being a missionary or fill in the blank, but rather it is to be a witness to the reconciling work of Jesus Christ in this world. And that is freeing, because then you can do whatever you want as long as, you know, you live out that witnessing role.
So this is a nub for me. And it's been one of your gifts to me that I don't think I've ever thanked you for. It's this other matter of business. My father was a carpenter, and he also was a kind of Christian socialist. So I grew up in a home where I think there was a kind of deep suspicion of business, particularly if you were successful.
Yeah.
Although there was a deeper suspicion, I think, of being bourgeois.
Yeah.
Of being middle class.
Right. Yeah.
So now that I can ask you, the reconciling work of Jesus Christ, put some flesh on that for me from the perspective of business.
Yeah.
Because business in the sort of ideological world in which we live is painted as, well, a variety of things come to mind immediately, but one of them is certainly within a kind of capitalist economy. It's certainly your primary responsibility is to accumulate wealth, and then we don't think much about anything else there. But you've right. thought a lot about other things there.
Yeah. Well, I think that, first of all, we do need to recognize that, we're taking on several different elements. I mean, capitalism. How does one deal with capital, the immediate, in an eternal world? So how do you place value on something that calls itself capitalism? That is, if you can't touch it, feel it, smell it, scratch it, it doesn't matter. Is I think one of the concerns that you have about capitalism. And that's something that suffers, whether you're a communist or a free right-wing enterpriser or whatever else, that if capital is what you're focused on, then you're going to lose sight of some bigger issues. I would submit as a completely different discussion at some point that I think that a lot of the Victorian capitalists were really deep Christians who thought a lot more about it than that. But even put that aside for a moment. I do think that capitalism has that tendency that you have to watch is both a reductionist understanding of what meaning is. That is, the purpose of capitalism is profit maximization. Not necessarily the case, but let's just say for a working assumption that is the case. It's a complex way to actually maximize profits because you have to take into account things like workers, humans. You've taken into account goods and all this sort of stuff. As an economic model, we could talk about it, but I don't. Let's skip that because that's not the basis for this conversation. But even if it was the best model, ultimately, if you're only focused on profits, isn't that a problem? What I think is missed by most Christians about business is the model of the Trinity. That is, we are told that the Father is the Father, but cannot be the Father without the Son. The Son can't be the Son without the Father. Neither can be the Father nor the Son without the Spirit. There is that perichoretic relationship between them, which is so communitarian. Well, maybe not communitarian, but is so interwoven. This perichoretic dance that is occurring at the level of the Trinity. And a lot of people have the image of business as some lone wolf, all alone, you know, pulls himself up by his own bootstraps, makes a ton of money. He finds a diamond, builds a diamond company, and makes, sort of like...
And tells the world to go to hell.
And it tells the world to go to hell because he knows how to do it better than anyone else. This sort of egotistical, maniacal attitude. But that actually isn't what you encounter in business. What you encounter in business is the ability to participate with others. The level of interdependence in business with people who you don't even know, people who are making goods that you use as source materials for what you're going to build. You know, if you ever have read, there's some great essays about this, like what goes into a pencil. And it is so complex, and there's so many things that go into the building of a particular pencil. And the amount of workers that have to be able to mine this back when it was lead and wood and, you know, that, et cetera, building the roads and everything else. What goes into building a pencil is so thoroughly integrated with one another. And yet, for many of us, we have the image of the lone wolf entrepreneur, business owner that misses all of that. The ability to participate in something greater than yourself with others with whom you have to work with, and with many who you don't even know, who have gone before you.
And you have to have confidence in them.
And you have to have confidence in them. And you're counting on them. And because of that, you'll be able to do your job. You know, in North America, the closest thing I think we actually see people explicitly acknowledge is maybe team sports. Mm-hmm. You know, and which is a whole other sort of religion that we could talk about, but it does get to that sense of interconnectivity that so few people seem to understand or reflect in their own lives. In a lives where, you know, we have taken the word individual and applied it to a human person, and taken the word person in law and applied it to a corporate entity, mm-hmm. The word, you know, that somehow a partnership or a corporation is a person, but if you actually have a heartbeat, you're an individual, speaks to this atomistic tendency in our culture. But business, interestingly, doesn't allow that to happen. Whatever the myth of it is, the fact is there isn't a business out there that doesn't have to constantly be interacting with humans, interacting with other humans. That's the only way it works. And at its best, it can be an expression of what we see in the Trinity. Self-giving for the other. And everyone assumes selfishness is the only motivation. I really don't think, you know, people use the example, and I'm sorry, I'm going on far too long, but people use the example of some sort of Darwinian understanding of life as sort of the survival of the fittest, et cetera, et cetera. But when you start reading notions of Darwin's notes himself, he speaks about you can more easily apply a metaphor of a mother giving birth to something for which she will not benefit, but her children will, than survival of the fittest, if you look at that metaphor. And you see that in business an awful lot. Most businesses don't survive. There are very few. If you go back and look, even the largest companies, maybe perhaps especially the largest companies.
What's the percentage, do you know?
Well, it's under 50% exist 30 years later. Hmm. Of the most successful businesses ever in the history of humankind, 30 years later. So why is that? What is the destructive nature? Well, a lot of it's got to do with that whole it's not that it goes away, it just morphs. It's not that we have fewer computers now than we did in 1981, but back then there was IBM and that was it. Now IBM really isn't a player. At one point it was Dell. Dell's not really a player. You could go through all these examples of companies that contribute to something that's bigger than itself, and others interacting with that come up with something better still.
So there's a few themes here that I've never really thought about very much. So it's very interesting to have you raise them. So in business, you are dealing with a variety of people. You're dealing with a variety of interests. You're dealing with all the human passions.
Yep.
All the human glory, perhaps, as well. And you have to do that on a daily basis. And you do it in the context of, as you just pointed out, you do it in the context of finitude.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because things are coming and going.
Yep.
Things are sprouting up and they're dying. And it's happening rather quickly. And you've got skin in the game.
Yep.
Around all of it. You've got skin in the game.
Absolutely.
So as I got older and, you know, I don't really know what my father thought of businessmen. I mean, some of his best friends were businessmen, I suppose. But there was this rhetoric in his world. There was I certainly grew up with a kind of suspicion about it.
I wouldn't say that suspicion is misplaced. Yeah. Remember, the reductionist tendency of our entire culture is very strong. And in business, it's stronger still because it's aimed at profit maximization, which means it's not aimed at 100 other things we might want to do. But business has never, well, I shouldn't say this. Some business holds itself out as all-encompassing, some sort of totalitarian. But you do see, if you go back to the Victorian understanding of business, that it was a very important part, but not nearly the entirety of one's life. So you could actually see how a company could be about profit maximization. But what happened with those profits were for an entirely different sphere of sovereignty. So the business person could definitely be the philanthropist, or the government could tax those profits to help for a social good that was commonly agreed upon. If all we are is about business, then that is lost. But held in with the proper tension, it is a tremendous good. It's unlocked. And we have found, I think most people would say objectively, the wealth that has been unlocked by this, the number of people have been raised out of poverty in the last century by the economy as we understand it, this modern economy. It's just,
smart.
I mean, it's without parallel.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly problems. I think any environmentalist would point out that there's some over. But any economist would just simply say, well, then that meant that we didn't price the environment properly. That if we had, and that's what carbon taxes are about, or et cetera, trying to figure out how do we actually value that appropriately. And then that can work within the system. So I don't want to be an apologist for business. But I do think that we can see, A, it's been tremendously successful in achieving a lot of very material benefits for our culture, whether or not it's life expectancy, health, education, the benefits that people have received, the lifestyle that most of us are used to, getting out of dire poverty into a whole bunch of other things. And it is largely responsible for that. So those are the goods. There are bads, but and one of those bads, I think, is a mindset, especially for those who think that it's a totalitarian regime, that business is the only metaphor that we have in our lives.
Did Calvin speak about it?
Oh yeah, quite a bit. And Calvin warned you about it. Now, Calvin's writing in the 1500s, not the 1900s, but he was once asked, is it okay if I own a large home? And his answer back was, well, it depends. How many kids you got? You know, if you got lots of kids, you should have a large home. If you don't have any children, then why would you need a large home? The point wasn't whether it was large or small. The point was, what was the motivation behind having it? I would say that since people have, you know, there's been the whole Protestant work ethic analysis. That is not Calvin. That's many centuries later, with an interpretation by a historian about what he saw in the Dutch economy. But I would say that
I think it's about Weber.
Yeah,
trying
exactly.
To find a reason for what he saw as a disease.
yeah, exactly. I mean, there's north and south. There's a whole bunch of stuff built into that. But I would say this, that Calvin did do. he really emphasized that the incarnation mattered. The priesthood of all believers, a la Luther, was really developed there, developed upon by Calvin, and really articulated that the material stuff of this world matters to God. He created it, he delights in it, and we should care likewise for it. And it gave meaning to what other people maybe in previous ages felt, well, I'm not a priest, so I don't really count, but I'll participate to earn credits or whatever else out of fear or anxiety. At its best, Calvin was able to say, no, what you do matters. If you're a blacksmith, if you're a carpenter, as your father was, and by the way, there are good examples of people whose fathers were carpenters.
There's a few.
A few. All of this matters because the incarnation matters. And I think Calvin was really emphatic about that point, that we are the priesthood of all believers. It isn't a class and we go along for the ride in some sort of priestly caste system, but actually every life matters. All of us have direct access to God. All of us are fully human, but we have access to the fully divine. And the emphasis on Christ is fully human, which I'm not suggesting the Catholic Church now suffers from this, but one would argue that the Catholic Church at the time of Calvin had moved away from a fully human Christ. And in fact, some see Mary as an answer to the fact that Christ wasn't fully human. Mary had to be fully human. And then even Mary, with the Assumption, et cetera, was moving away from being fully human. As a human people, we have constantly struggled with how can you be fully God and fully man. Calvin and Luther before him strongly emphasized that was the central aspect of understanding our God. And it's not just historical, it's present. That is, today, at this moment, as you and I are having this conversation, the Trinity that is that we are participating in has someone who is fully human, who has been ascended into heaven. And we sit with him at the right hand of God the Father. So when you are given that assurance and you are told that you can access Scripture, you can access God directly in prayer, you can access, that many of the practices of the Roman Catholic tradition, in the 1400s and 1500s could stop because they were more about reinforcing priestly authority and privilege than actual theology. Calvin said no to all of that. So does he speak to business? Or does he speak to wealth? Does he speak to our role in this world? I think tremendously so.
How would you sum up Calvin's notion of the Christian vocation? Or let me put it much more precisely, his understanding of the human vocation.
Right. Well, I think it has to be seen in light of the Catholic understanding at the time. And again, I don't want to be heard to be saying this is what the Catholic tradition has become, because I think that under John Paul II and so many other great thinkers in the 20th century, this is not what... But at the time, there were the priests, and then there were the rest of the scum. Or the... You didn't quite make the A-team, so, okay, go along and do what you can. But you're never going to be what the A team is. You're the substitute on the volleyball team.
It's so curious, David. In the Orthodox Church, where I worship, we have a long history of priesthood becoming a family business.
Right.
It's one of the things the Catholics solved, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think I understand why they solved it, and it was a sensible thing to solve. So I've noticed that young men who are born into families where their father's a priest often give some considerable thought to it, or end up, particularly if they're lazy, they end up becoming
clergy because it's an easy gig.
Yeah.
And it gives you it gives you status and all sorts of things. But there's something remarkable about it.
The Orthodox tradition has a rich understanding of the priesthood of all believers. The clergy, at the beginning of the liturgy, the first act is to come out in front of the royal gates and to bow to the congregation and to say, "May I serve the liturgy with you?" Because it's understood to be served together. We are doing this together. So that notion of the priesthood of all believers is very vital and very alive. However, our priesthood is first and foremost present in us in our very being. Human beings, when they're born into the world, are born, this would be the classical comment on this, our vocation is to be birth givers of divine love in the world.
Yeah.
And how is that manifest? Well, two primary ways. It is manifest through blessing and healing. So we are all called to be to bless and to heal. There is no vocation above that. That is the elemental and the highest of human vocations. So it's interesting. When a person is ordained, I don't recall if I've ever mentioned this to you before, but when a person is ordained in the Orthodox Church, their baptismal garment, which we all have, is covered up by their priestly, their new priestly garment. Their baptismal garment is their fundamental priestly garment, but it's covered up and it's bound. Cuffs bind it, belts bind it. It's bound because they are giving up. Well, that's putting it a little too strong. They are tying down their priestly vocation, that is to be a priest for the life of all of creation, to bless and heal all of creation. They are making a new covenant that they will take on themselves, they will sacrifice and take on themselves the responsibility to be the one that gives order to the gathered ecclesia. They are binding themselves to the altar, and it isn't the altar of the world, it's the altar of the church. So I have pointed out to a few of the young men, I've asked them to consider, as they discern priesthood, you need to spend some time thinking and praying about whether you really, whether it is really appropriate for you to limit your priesthood to the church.
Right.
To bind yourself to the church. We need people to do that, and we need good people to do that. But you do have to appreciate this is a substantial restriction.
Yeah.
It's a substantial restriction. And it will have implications, tremendous implications, for what you can do and how you can do it, which I do not have. I have much more freedom than any priest has around these matters. So it's curious. And what I hear in your reflection here and in Calvin is a very heightened sense that one's priesthood, one's fundamental vocation as the birth giver of divine love in the world, which is another way of saying a reconciler.
Right, yeah.
One who is willing to enter into the fray and to seek ways which make the ordinary aspects of life serve life.
Yeah.
Instead of serving interest.
Right.
Simply.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wouldn't say that Calvin does that with without some unfortunate consequences. You know, I think of when you walk into your sanctuary, you're able to kiss the icon of Mary and the icon of Christ. And that, you know, that Mary, her title is that of, you know, bearing God into the world. And that is our vocation. And if the evangelicals of North America had got it right, the little rubber bands they'd have around their wrists would have been, what would Mary do? Not what would Jesus do? Because we're called to be that human who was called to bear Christ into the world. Not to be Christ, but to bear Christ into the world. And certainly, I think that my tradition has, the politest thing you could say is de-emphasize the role of Mary. But I think a stronger would be is that throw out the baby with the bathwater, or in this case, the baby's mother with the bathwater, in understanding what our vocation is. But it is, as you say, a very broad understanding of vocation. And this is a difficulty and an anxiety for the young Christian who's saying, you know, I got to get this right or else God won't be happy. You know, God has a plan for me, and they're trying to figure out how they figure that out. You know, like it's a Sunday Times acrostic puzzle or something, that somehow I'll figure out exactly what God has in mind for me. It places a horrible, horrible, to me, pressure on getting it right. And then whatever they do, they're not going to be perfect at it. So then they've got it always working from guilt that they're not serving God properly. And then in any organization, maybe they should be fired. Maybe they're not competent at what they do. And how do you deal with that? So all of those issues come about when you get too specific about what it is. You're called to be a blacksmith or a carpenter or a lawyer or a school teacher or whatever. Maybe you're not. I over time, I think it's been much more important in my legal practice how I treat my staff and my clients and my opponents, which are different than enemies, than what I do. But rather, you know, the practices that go into how you engage with those people. That's probably closer to my vocation.
There's been so much mischief by thinking that God is a planner.
Yeah, exactly.
And that somehow or other, he has something important for you to do. Which can only be done in one way.
Yeah.
As opposed to understanding that there really is only one vocation that is given to us in our being. And that vocation is to be the birth giver of divine love in the world.
Right.
So you also studied law, and you brought law and business together in your work. What is it about law that intrigued you?
Well, I think that most people recognize you understand it a bit better looking backwards than forwards. Why did I go into law school? I have nobody in my family or even in friendship or my parents' friends or anybody that had been a lawyer. So why would I have gravitated to law? I never took a law course or anything else.
But you had Calvin.
But I had Calvin.
And he was a lawyer.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I so much had Calvin then had law or whether I had law and then found Calvin. You know, I was 19 years old when I was admitted to law school, or 20 years old when I was admitted to law school. I think that it's what I love about law is that whatever analytic gifts I've been given are useful in the practice of law and work well in the practice of law. So you have analytical skills, you have a natural personality predisposition. If you're a lover, not a fighter, you probably don't go into law. if you are, you know, someone who doesn't like conflict, you probably don't go into law. If you're a person who develops a certain view and either doesn't feel comfortable looking at it from a different perspective or feels that they have to support that position once they've adopted it, like a, you know, a home fan of a local team, then you probably don't go into law. Law is an unusual thing. So is accounting. So is engineering. So is, you know, any of the questions. The bigger question for me now, and when we talk about law, is my concern that at the time of Calvin, or many of the great jurists that we know over the centuries, that like any of the professions, we have largely slipped from the question of why do we do something, to the question of how. And that, so law today is not what it was even when I studied it, but it certainly wasn't what was happening two centuries earlier, where the most important question of law was the why, and it was why justice. You know, and so you might study distributive justice, retributive justice. You'd study what Plato said about it, what Aquinas said about it, what you know, Kant said, John Rawls, whoever. But you'd be focused on the why. And I was fortunate; I went to a law school that largely focused on the why. But even then, most of the students were complaining they weren't learning a lot of how. And technique, largely in our Western culture, has replaced the primal question of what are you professing, i.e. a professional. What are you professing by what you do? And that, to me, is something certainly that Calvin would have given me, was the primacy of the why over the technique of the how. And whatever one does, whether it is in the traditional professions or, you know, staying at home with the family or, you know, being in advertising or whatever else, I think the question why is essential and more important than the how. What I find interesting in the youngest generation of workers now is they seem to be asking that question and are deeply dissatisfied with the answer of what they're doing. And so you're seeing job turnover way higher, dissatisfaction with jobs much higher. I don't take that as a bad thing. I take that as a wonderful corrective to perhaps what the last several generations have done, reducing work to technique, when work was given to us in Genesis as a gift. When I think that a good example is, for so many people, we have confused work and toil. At the end of Genesis, you know, when cast out of the garden, they're told they'll have to toil. That is a punishment. But to work, that's a gift. But the work comes from the why. My why relates to justice. I feel a keen thing that I know a lot of people in my culture don't feel about procedural fairness. And so all you have to do is be in a room of lawyers and you know the difference, because, you know, you hear culture, a society has criticized somebody for doing something or allegedly done something. And as soon as you use the word allegedly, you're probably in a room with lawyers, because we still have a sense of a presumption of innocence, still have a sense of procedural fairness, that even if the person's guilty, if they haven't been treated with the dignity that they ought to be treated with, that they shouldn't be punished for it. A lot of that's lost outside of justice. And over the years, I think that that's where I've identified my particular calling to the practice of law.
Hmm. Now, you've also been quite successful in many ways at what you've done. You've given a great deal of attention to various organizations, charitable organizations, educational organizations, the church. You've worked as hard there as you have, I suspect, in your business work and your legal work. Two things that interest me about that. One is, why? Why have you done that with such vigor? And also following from that, not quite sure how to ask the question. I've admired your stewardship of your time and of your resources, and the way in which you have been a guardian of that stewardship, have given considerable attention to what is a responsible way of exercising it. In our society, we speak about charity, charitable work. So, on the one hand, why that extraordinary amount of effort you have put into what are ostensibly non-business organizations, organizations which are doing something else within the public sphere. And also, your understanding of, you can ask the question better than I, your understanding of your responsibility to see that what you have is made available to others.
Yeah.
In order that they may also flourish in particular ways.
Well, I'd like to believe this, the second. stewardship is a really key word for me. Really key. I had to preach about this, one of these sermons where they bring up a business guy to preach, and everyone should inwardly groan when they hear that. But, and I took a text that is usually used by those people who go up and do it, the parable of the talents, where, there are three servants, the master's going away, he gives one 10, one 5, and one talent. Now, a talent is worth, these days, somewhere about $1 million to $1.5 million U.S. So, big numbers. And these are servants. They're not used to working with those types of numbers. And yet they're given 10 or 5 or one of them. And said, go do something with it, and I'll be back. And the traditional way of reading it, the person who had 10 got another 10. The one with 5 got 5, another 5. And the person with the 1 just simply buried it in the ground and didn't do anything with it. And when the master came back, the 10 was rewarded. The one who doubled it from 10 to 20, great. The one with 5 to 10, great. The one with the 1, though, was cast out and do no more. And it can read like the most horrible works righteousness parable of all of the Gospels, of somehow you better perform or else you're in deep trouble here. But I think that the hermeneutical key to that parable is that the first two servants, while they weren't comfortable with working those types of numbers, were comfortable with the master. They actually took joy in the master beforehand. They knew that this was a master who risked. I mean, the fact that this master gave them that money showed that he was a master who didn't mind taking big risks and was exuberant and, threw all the money on 13 black, or whatever it was. That's the master you're talking about, not this parsimonious. And so when the third master says, well, I know you were a harsh person who reaped what you hadn't sown, that had done this and had done that, and sort of painted this horrible picture of the master.
And the third servant.
And the third servant who had only received one talent. And so I just buried it because I never wanted to upset you. And he said, well, wouldn't you have at least put it in the bank and made some interest that way? I mean, come on. I mean, surely if you thought I was that, you would have done that. What I think is revealing there is that the first two, there's no difference between the 5 talents and the 10 talents. But both of them are welcomed into, welcomed them right into the life of the master. Whereas the third one is cast out. They're not cast out because they didn't perform. It was because they never knew the master. They thought the master was this parsimonious, angry, judgmental, works righteousness type of guy who, if he didn't perform, you were going to be cast out. And not shockingly, that's what happens. But it's because of us, not because of the master. How do we perceive that? So I've always grown up, I've been very fortunate to have grown up in a home where I was always told that the master was exuberant, risk-taking, And there was nothing you could ever do that would cause him to love you less. And it was impossible for him to love you more than what he already did. So if you grow up in that environment, as children who grow up in those households themselves, they tend to do really well because they're given the freedom to experiment and take risks and fail, but to do well. And that's the type of faith one should have, I think, is that there's nothing that is going to separate me from the love of God. I'm absolutely told that. Like, this isn't some weird interpretation of scripture. This is like just straight out of Romans 8. So in light of that, hey, let's have some fun. Let's see what we could do. What gifts do I have that I could bring to this? So you ask me, why do I get involved? You know, about 50% of my time is on charitable boards. What I find is some of the most interesting people I will ever encounter on those boards. They've got a vision for a kingdom that is magnificent. They have a heart for the poor that is staggering. They've got a wisdom beyond anything I will ever have. What they lack is the ability to get from here to there. Lots of them. They mean well, but they don't have that skill set. They got all the other stuff, but they haven't got that. And the great thing about business and law is I've learned over 3 decades is how to get from here to there. I know that if this is what we're trying to achieve, let's articulate it. Let's set goals for it. Let's figure out a plan to get there. And let's hold ourselves accountable to it. Let's resource it. Most of what I just said there sounds very simple, but on most charitable boards, that is radical thinking. And I am an institutionalist. I believe in institutions. So when the institution doesn't live up to what it says it ought to be doing, then we have to hold people accountable. Sometimes that has meant, sadly, replacing people who are working there. Because the vision and the purpose is bigger than any one of us. It also means that the board should turn over, et cetera, et cetera. So I get quite excited about that because I can throw a lot of skill sets at that. While they aren't as important as the other ones, they are, in that context, rarer than the other ones. And so what I can offer there is great. And it's from a personal point of view, there's a tremendous amount of satisfaction I get helping an organization that's got a much broader vision than profit maximization, do what it wants to do and believes it ought to be doing, because there's so few other people around the table who have that skill set to do that. So that's the why question. Why? It brings tremendous joy. Yes, even if I wasn't getting joy, and there are lots of times I don't, there are lots of times it's quite frustrating. There are lots of times when I'm having to do things that are really difficult and time consuming, and no one recognizes the value of that, but it's important to do, so I just continue doing it. So I get that. But overall, there's a real sense of joy of seeing it grow from this to that, and being part of that, to participate in that. So that's probably the why of why I do it. The other question about stewardship, and I think I may have answered through explaining the why. And it might have been also from the earlier explanation about business. Ultimately, I am not a reductionist. I'm quite the opposite. So I think that business is wonderful, even with its reduced vision of profit maximization. But I'm never fooling myself that that's the whole story or what we ought to be doing ultimately is caught up in its entirety through profit maximization. It's just not the case. But I'm not doing anything that there haven't been generations and generations. I think it's a fairly recent phenomenon that people have lost sight of the why. For most generations, people have had that why in there. And so we have seen not-for-profit organizations flourish in the largest capital markets of the world. Just as a simple example, and this is not to make a pitch for it, but in Canada, where we have taxation to do a lot of the social good that our neighbors to the south in the U.S., they don't have it. It isn't surprising to me, at least, that in the U.S. you see six times the amount of charitable giving than you see in Canada, because people see it as a natural response in the States, where in Canada we see it as a state obligation. Whether you want, and there are good arguments on both sides, that somehow this shouldn't be an act of charity, but should be a right of every person, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to argue the validity of either of those two viewpoints. But it is interesting that the natural human response when the government isn't doing something is saying something ought to be done, and I'll write a check to do that, and I'll join this organization, and I will help out this way. I think it's wonderfully affirming of the Imago Dei in all of us.
I'm increasingly I increasingly ponder the curiosity, with great curiosity, how in a liberal democratic society where one assumes the state should be doing everything, we now find ourselves in a position where the liberal state no longer carries within it what one of its impulses was, which was an impulse of regard for pluralism.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. That pluralism, the kind of attack on pluralism that exists in liberal democratic societies, is quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
And so the notion that non-governmental agencies have a capacity to do certain things for certain people, and that government and law ought to create a landscape in which that can happen.
Yes.
We've turned that around.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So in Canada, we see that so much of the infrastructure of the country was created by religious institutions.
Yes.
And all those institutions end up migrating into the public sphere. And then we now face legislation and what have you, which wants to hem in what in the hands of non-governmental agencies could be accommodated.
Yeah, yeah. To go back to Calvin and his successors, Kuyper, I think, is a really helpful here, and the Catholic tradition as well.
That's the Dutch.
The Dutch
Prime Minister, theologian.
Yeah. Yeah, if you could imagine a theologian would get elected prime minister, that's what the Dutch were able to do in the late 1800s. His name is Kuyper. And he had talked about spheres of sovereignty. And what he meant by that was that the state is not absolute. In the 20th century, we've experienced a few people who've thought the state was absolute. Mussolini, Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot.
Mao.
You know, that's not a good track record. So opposed to that, Kuyper had, and many both religious but also political forefathers of his, whether it was Tocqueville or Calvin or etc., had a proper role for the state, but also a proper role for a whole bunch of other intermediary organizations, whether it was education, health, family, service clubs, etc., etc. You had this role for them that was important for understanding what our culture was about, that the state did not encompass all of our culture because it wasn't totalitarian. And in that environment, we allowed for human flourishing because everyone got to participate. Once we professionalized it, once the church was told, thanks for building the schools, thanks for building the hospitals, thanks for taking care of the poor, we'll take over from here. And it's not quite that simple, because a lot of them were also in the politics. They were the government as well. A lot of Christians were involved in politics. And their natural impulse was, this should not be an act of charity. It should be a right of every person, because of the dignity of humanity, that this should be a right, and therefore the government should take care of it. I think the unintended consequence that came out of that was that the state became an invasive species of plant that it is important to have the state. But once it starts growing in an area where it ought not to be growing, it becomes invasive. And what we have seen as a result, like any invasive species, is that natural plants die. And so we've seen a lot of the natural community programs, the gatherings of families, whether it's churches or service clubs or others, have largely gone away because of the power of the state. De Tocqueville warns us from a political perspective that anytime the state encounters an individual, the individual will lose. It's only through these intermediary organizations where we gather the stickiness and stuffness of what it means to live together, to participate together, that you can have a healthy democracy. So what we call democracy should not be reduced to merely the elected government. And what we call liberal should definitely not be reduced to strident requirements of that government, but rather the natural desire for freedom, not just freedom from, but freedom to do things that we have in a culture. The good news is it's latently there. People respond, they react about it. But when you have billions that are, when you have a government that runs billions or trillions of dollars of debt and deficits, they're very powerful. And it can cow a people, including, to your point, pluralism, where we allow for different views to be expressed. Once it becomes government opinion that this is the proper expression, we shut down everything else, unless there's a really healthy liberal democracy.
Do you see the Conservative Party in Canada? It's gone through some trials and hiccups and tribulations. It used to be called Progressive. I remember somebody like Walter McLean,
right,
who you and I both know. I had a good friend here in Alberta, William Perdushny, who was a lawyer and was a kind of insider, played golf with Peter Lougheed and what have you. What was striking to me about them, the two of them particularly, because they're as close as I've ever gotten to knowing people who were intimately involved in Conservative politics. What was striking to me about them is that both of those men had a very fine sense of the significance of various kinds of organization, education and what have you. They thought that the state should perhaps support those things,
right,
but it certainly wasn't in their vision that the state should be running those things necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you see this issue that we have been chatting about here of the invasive government? Is the Conservative, well, I don't know if they should be cast in terms of the party or in terms of those people who have been the intellectual heft of the Conservative perspective in our country. Do they have a regard these days for this danger? And is this danger present in the Conservative sphere as well as the Liberal sphere? How do you see it?
Well, we're having this conversation just a few weeks after the re-election of the Liberal government in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So some of what we're going to talk about is probably colored by a campaign or particular, the leadership of this person or the election promise of that. But I think I'd pull back. First of all, I do think that there's a big difference between conservatism and the Conservative Party.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatism, at its best.
And I guess this is what I'm really asking you.
Yeah.
Is conservatism still present in the Conservative Party? Or
well, the good news is I think it's more present in the Canadian Conservative Party than it is in the American Republican Party. Conservatism at its best, the little platoons,
right,
speaking of what we were just speaking a moment ago, of all these other organizations, that the Conservative movement is principally about conserving that what ought to be conserved. It is to say, there are some things that are important. It's about an incrementalism based on building on some foundations that are important for our culture. Even if the best answer to all of our problems existed tomorrow, conservatism largely would argue, well, slow down a bit and let's just go slowly at this, because there's a complexity here to human nature and to human institutions that we're not sure of. And that is diametrically opposed by progressivism, which assumes that there is a correct answer that we are moving towards, and we need to always be moving towards that, the progressive nature of that. I think the progressive conservatives were always a irreconcilable tension. The progressive party that existed that had married up with the conservatives largely to try to, in some way or other, fight the Liberal Party in Canada. I think actually progressivism is far more antithetical towards conservatism than the Liberal Party was, because the Liberal Party, at its best, respected the liberty of each person. All those parties have become is different than what the foundational underpinnings of them. But conservatism at its best was about recognizing what was good and trying to conserve that. So you're asking...
And recognizing its institutional structure.
Its institutional structure.
What institutions
That's right.
can nurture that.
That's right.
And encourage that.
Yeah.
Help
and so in Canada, there's been a strong red Tory, to use the term, undercurrent of a lot of conservatism. There really hasn't been much of the neoconservative or the libertarian. Libertarian's largely not there at all in Canadian conservatism. So it's not about the individual versus society and, you know, just leave me alone type of attitude, but actually is about government is important but should be limited. And I think that it is correct that conservatives, when in power at their best, see that government should support a lot of these things. Whether or not is the famous phrase of Mulroney, you know, the best social program is a job, or et cetera, et cetera. But how you understand support, I think once you're in power, it's very difficult not to exercise the levers of power. And so support soon becomes like, a mafia boss who comes around to support a local business. You know, it's protected, but is it really thriving? When the government, there is a natural tendency of this invasive species I talked about. This is just human nature. If any of us were given the ability to take money from others and have power over others, we would tend towards a totalitarian, you know, and that's the old line of, you know, power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, and conservatives are as guilty of that as liberals, but they probably feel badly about it. You know, there's still a remnant of concern that isn't progressive in the way that we find in the modern day Liberal Party, where there's that. I think modus vivendi is another really important understanding politically, where do we agree as a people that we are all, if we were just smart enough and I was going to say virtuous enough, that's old language, but if we were virtuous enough, smart enough, and intentional enough, then we would all get to the same answer. And you still see, you see remnants like that where people say, oh, well, it's just a case of ignorance. If we just put it in the school system, everyone will learn that X is right. Climate control, for example, or something else. There's a whole other school of thought that says, you know what, the human nature isn't that way. We're never all going to agree on something. So the best we can do in this world is agree to disagree on some things, and that civilization is about learning how to disagree with one another effectively and without violence. And that's that modus vivendi. The modern liberal state is absolutely opposed to the modus vivendi. They want to make a purer state. In a sense, they're the new Puritans. The modus vivendi state says, you know what, I may disagree with you. I may think you're absolutely wrong. I might even think it's immoral, but I'll live with it because you've got a community that agrees with it, and I've got a community that disagrees with it, but we all have to learn how to get along here. That tends to be more, you find now, more of a conservative position, but not on some issues. The temptation to try to legislate morality and only one answer to it because of a certainty that I have, which takes a certain level of hubris, which most, even the greatest kings through history didn't have, where they would insist that one, that everybody believe exactly what they believe. That's a troubling aspect of our modern culture that conservatives, when they reflect on it, say no to that.
So you've pulled forward John Gray's
yeah.
Two Faces of Liberalism.
Two Faces of Liberalism is a good example of that.
On the one hand, we have the modus vivendi
yeah.
kind of liberalism. And what was his term for the kind of liberalism that funnels everything down?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember it right now, if he had a specific term. But it wasn't a compliment, whatever no, it was. Yeah.
Convergent.
Convergent. Convergent. That's it. Convergent liberal. That's it.
Where it may take some time, but in fact,
Everybody's
going to have to be on the same page at a certain point.
And I got to say, as a Christian, not thinking about this in my early days, I was much more of a convergent liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
One day, every knee shall bow, every mm-hmm. tongue shall declare,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
as if somehow it's just, we just got to keep working at it and eventually everyone will agree with me. You know, I think that as a guy who's now in his 50s, I've grown to appreciate most people are never going to agree with me. As a matter of fact, I don't agree with me many of the times. we have to have a culture that allows for second best alternatives, assuming that humanity isn't perfectible.
Walter McLean's comment to me, and I loved it. He said, David, sometimes you have to put some water in your wine.
Mine. Yeah, that's it.
He would say that. How is he, do you know?
I don't, no.
Yeah, I haven't talked to him for ages.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, David. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been great chatting about this.
I would like some time to also sit and talk about the church. You've been doing some work with the Presbyterians on this, so let's do that next time.
Okay. Well, I'm glad there's a next time. As a matter of fact, right now it's a really big issue in the church.
Yeah.
And I have taken great comfort from the Westminster system of loyal opposition. In order to be loyal to something, sometimes your role is to be the opposition. So we've got some big issues around human sexuality. And the things that we're doing there. And what upsets me most, and this is where I understand my vocation within law, is I'm offended because you can see the agenda driving the actions, which in my mind has no place in the church. God drives. But when somebody wants something and then takes actions where it's denying other people either their full rights or consultation or whatever, this is what also makes me Presbyterian. You know, in a model where you have a bishop, you learn to live it with it and lump it. But in the Presbyterian circle where everyone talks this stuff through, to see someone actually, because they have some power, using that or misusing that to achieve a particular end is very frustrating for me. And so I'm fortunate because I don't get a check from the church. So I can speak with a freedom that others can't. And right now I'm in the middle of all of that. So it's maybe in a year from now we can talk about that.
David's formation, both within the tradition of Christianity and particularly Calvin's understanding of the call to be a reconciling voice in a broken world, his legal studies, when justice and its deep purpose was still lively in the university, his continued engagement in philosophical and theological thinking, and his commitment and friendship with artists has made for an excellent life. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.